On 11.16 SEN, The Science of Sport with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada and Mark Fabreo.
Morning, folks. Welcome to The Science of Sport at, let's go with 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. This is the show where every week we dissect all things sport and training and performance and nutrition and psychology and all the stuff that kind of surrounds getting in shape, playing sport, improvement, learning, adapting, evolving, the psychology, the physiology. Jackie Lauder joins me. Hi.
Good morning. How are you going?
Very good. Mark Fabreo, of course, is
Who's
absent.
That? His name's in the intro, but I don't know who he is anymore.
That's right. He used to be part of the team. He may or may not be back next week. Allegedly, will be back next week, Professor Mark Fabreo. If you're listening, big fella, good morning. Where are you? You are missed. But he'll be back on deck next week.
Right.
How's your week gone?
Oh, it's been smashed this week. Been very busy.
Can I ask, is this a strange question when I ask, is being a psychologist and working with people and their staff, we'll just put it in the stuff basket.
Yep.
Is it seasonally busier?
Yes. Yeah. It's not a fun time of year for a lot of people. And obviously all the advertisement, everything we see at the moment is very much love and happiness and family. And that's not really the case for a lot of people. So it's also why I tend to work through most of the time this time of year. But yeah.
You're looking very Christmassy.
I'm going to a Christmas gathering this afternoon.
A Christmas gathering?
I am. Well, it's not a party.
What is it?
It's a gathering of a few of us just from work. So right. Just people that work in my allied health department with me.
So this is not sport, but let's just indulge for 2 or 3 minutes in...
Well, I guess this is the Grinch having a conversation with me too.
What are you saying? I love Christmas.
Yeah. I've never seen you get into the Christmas spirit ever.
Whatevs. For people who struggle at Christmas with the, you know, because they feel lonely or disconnected or, you know, whatever they feel, you know, depressed, flat, what can they, I know there's no universal fix for that, but what's some things that they can do to make it a little bit better time?
Yeah, I mean, getting outside and keep exercising and those sort of things are obvious, but I have quite a few clients that because they don't have families and those sort of things, they do a lot of volunteer work at this time of year. So St. Finney's, you know, there's still a lot of homeless and stuff working in some of the kitchens.
Yep.
So the food kitchens and that over the Christmas period, and they really enjoy it and it makes them feel like they're giving something, plus they've got people around. So, you know, I think a lot of those sort of things are really helpful for people.
I used to go every year for about 8 or 9 years. I kind of stopped because I just was going down to see my parents to a church in Cheltenham to do Christmas lunch, which was for Bayside, give them a plug, Bayside Church, and just spent my Christmas day serving and waiting on and mucking around with homeless people who came in or people who were, you know, disadvantaged in some way. Some of them were homeless, some of them just were really, really struggling, and best Christmas day ever.
Yeah, it's really rewarding work, and I think, like I said, if it stops you and gets you out of your own head, you know, feeling that sadness or that loneliness, and that doesn't necessarily completely take it away, but it does feel good when you can maybe put a smile on somebody else's face. So
I was talking to someone yesterday, one of my mates, and he goes, "Gee, I hate this time of the year." I'm like, "Why is that, mate? Not a fan of Christmas?" He goes, No footy.
No,
I'm like, really?
Right. He probably needs a few other interests.
He gets a little bit flat when there's...
Oh, yeah.
And even when there's footy news, he's okay. Like, because January, mid-January, footy news starts to wind up. Well, it's like he gets a bit of a fix.
Yeah.
But there's a period of about, you know, like now, where there's really very little going on in terms of what's happening, a couple of random things, but there's nothing to get his teeth into. And he said, this is the worst time of the year for me. I really struggle.
Right. Well,
that's a sport addict.
It is a sport addict. What he could do is if he wanted to pick up the Herald Sun today, he could have a look. Page 39, there's a list of the top five wasted AFL talents.
Why don't you, and for I'm sure some of our listeners have read that, but let's just have a quick listen to who the top five, who wrote that, by the way?
Okay.
According to whom? Do we know?
It's edited by Stephen Akos. So
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's just go one to five. If you, we'll just open this up too. This is not really that kind of consistent with what we do here, but it's okay.
It can be, sort of.
Well, that's right, because we talk about maximising talent. So if you've got somebody that in the AFL space or maybe another sport who you think, you know, wow, they were gifted, but they just didn't even get close to maximising their potential, either give us a buzz, 9429 1116 or 0433 98 1116 on the SMS. So top five, going from number five down to number one in terms of wasted AFL talent.
Okay, so number five was Brendan Favola.
Was he?
They said even though he played 204 games, he probably, and he got 623 goals, he could have got a lot closer to 1,000. And I would agree with that.
I know Fev reasonably well. I'm going to ask him if he, next time I see him, I'm going to ask him if he agrees with that. Because he might agree. He might well agree.
Yeah, he might.
But there's no doubting, super talent.
Yes. And I think that's why everyone thinks if he had have controlled maybe some of his other off-field things, that he would have done a lot more. Yeah.
Kicked 1,000, played 300.
Okay, number four is Damien Cubito from Essendon. So they've just said he could make the ball talk when his switch was on.
Super skillful. And our guest that we've got coming up also has got some insight into his talent. Yep. We've got a very special guest coming up at about 25 past 10.
Number three was Adrian McAdam from North Melbourne. So 23 goals in his first three games, but he left the sport by the age of 23.
Yeah. So and I think kicked.
That probably makes
was,
sense.
Somebody will correct me. Was he the player who kicked seven goals in a grand final?
Don't know.
I think you may have somebody. Somebody tell me, please.
Okay. Number two was Alan Jakovic from Melbourne. In 47 games, kicked 201 goals. And then
really?
Just kind of.
Really?
Yeah, that surprised me too.
That is.
So I guess that probably makes sense why he's made the list. And then the number one was Nathan Ablett. So premiership player at 21 and then 3 months later left the game.
Made a couple of comebacks.
Yeah. But I mean, that was his choice. And so it's not saying, I think what the article is basically saying is that these guys could have done a lot more. They weren't, it's not bagging them out. It's just saying it. I think, do you have an athlete that you think is probably wasted talent, whether it be football or anyone else?
Well, I've worked with a few over the years. I don't really want to call any one out, but I've worked with some netballers as well because I was at the Vixens and Melbourne Phoenix for collectively 7 years.
What about someone you don't know? Mark Philippoussis.
Well,
for
I reckon maybe Mark Phil. I was just thinking tennis, and I was thinking I hope that Bernard Tomic doesn't go that way because he has the potential to be a top five player. Whether or not he ever gets there, I think. Tennis players, for whatever reason, are a unique bunch in that they seem to be, a percentage of them anyway, more volatile and more fragile and more high maintenance, maybe because it's such a high profile sport in this country. What are you smirking at?
I'm smirking because come and spend a week in my office and you can't
with
hide.
Tennis
like,
players?
No.
Mum, parents?
Every sport, like when you're saying they're unique and they're volatile and all that sort of stuff. And I guess I see it across every sport. So I certainly wouldn't.
All right. So as a psychologist who's sitting in a room with athletes all the time.
Yes.
So we're not talking about particular people. Who are the athletes that, and again, there's probably, this is generalizing, but is there a group of athletes that tend to be more balanced and tend to be better at self-managing from an emotional and a psychological point of view?
No, I wouldn't say so.
Really?
No, yeah.
So it's really across just about the individual.
Very much about the individual. But yeah, I think, like I said, for me, I think Mark Philippoussis had a lot more in him. And I think he has come out and said that, which is why, you know, he's wanted to maybe do a little bit of work with Kyrgios and make sure that he doesn't make some of the same mistakes that Mark made, because I just think he had the ability to be world number one for. And he got there to, you know, the US Open, I think, final a couple of times, just couldn't kind of get it over the line. But, wow, he was an amazing player if he had got more consistency.
So when for example, Andre Agassi and Roger Federer were young, they were quite tempestuous, volatile young things at
Stefan Edberg was the same. He was very sooky.
And Pete Sampras was a little bit racket throwy for a while as well, but kind of matured. Did they mature primarily, or did they change in terms of their behaviour and they seem to be a lot more in control and calm and efficient with their emotions as they got older? Was that a probably maturity thing, or was that a working with a psych who helped them thing, or
both? I think it's probably a combination of both, and it's not necessarily even just working with a psych. I think it depends on the people that you put around you. So if you're, you know, you and I would have both seen it, is that some athletes, if they're really good, everybody in their team, all they do is tell them that they're really good.
Mm.
And if they make an error, it's always someone else's fault. You know, if someone's made a comment about them, or they lost their cool in their sport or whatever it is, it's because they were baited. It wasn't about, you know, well, they need to get that more under control. So I think who you put around you is so vital in terms of how you mature as an athlete and how you understand what you've got to do.
Surely one of the challenges for coaches at a junior level or amateur level is dealing with, you know, if you're a, like I was a coach when I was 16, I don't know how I ended up in that role, but I was coaching a team of under 14s when I was 16 years old. I was quite a mature 16-year-old, obviously.
What were you coaching?
I was coaching footy. So I played footy.
This is new information.
Yeah, I played junior, senior footy at 16. So I was an okay footballer, not a good footballer, okay.
Yep.
Senior country football. 17, sorry. But I was quite a mature, but I had 40 players and I was a 16-year-old. And so you've got 40 attitudes, egos, personalities, and I had no clue. Like I was pretty good at just running drills and organising everyone and, you know, getting a team out. But in terms of managing people on that level, is that something that we should expect coaches to do or
Absolutely.
Not?
Absolutely. Yep. I mean, this is where the whole realm of emotional intelligence and understanding the emotional brain and all of that is just so important, because in any sport you can find a number of people that know how to set up that sport and know the techniques of it and probably have a lot of understanding on a world scale of what you need to be successful in that sport. But if you can't manage people and recognize the personality, that absolutely changes how you talk to them. You know, you and I could have someone in front of us. Let's say we've got an athlete who's in the middle of competition and they're highly emotional and they're starting to, you know, get a bit anxious and we can see their frustration. And if you don't know their personality the same way I do, what you say and what I say, both with exactly the same intention, which is to calm this person down and assist them, but your words versus my words are going to have very, very different impacts. And this is what, that's why coaching is not an easy job, and you've got to have respect for those career coaches. And why you look at most sports, their coaches are, you know, in their 50s and 60s, because they have a little bit more people understanding.
What's the value of application of, role of, if any, personality profiling in sporting clubs?
Huge.
Okay.
Huge. Because,
so can you just explain? Explain one, what is a personality profile? Because probably most of our listeners haven't had one done or participated in one. What is a personality profile? And I know there's a bunch online. Is there one, if somebody goes, I want to figure out, or I want to get a bit of an idea, am I this or that, where might we go?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you want to have one that's got really high validity and you're able to really see how that works for you, you need to go and see a psychologist who can do it, because your really good ones, you can't just access online.
Right.
You might get minor versions of them and give you a little bit of an idea, but if you want it done properly, you need to go and see a professional, because we actually have to pay to get those tests.
Right.
But basically what a personality profile does is it shows us where someone's strengths and their weaknesses are, where they may cope, where they may not cope. It doesn't tell us if, like, a lot of people think that it gives us a complete reading into them. It definitely gives us a better insight. But if we're going to use that in sport, so all of the draftees in the AFL will do a number of personality profiles. So it might tell us if someone's adaptable and how they might cope under pressure. So we go, okay, well, if I'm coaching you and I know that that's what you're like, not purely from just what I've seen, but as you go up higher levels, if we get into the last 2 minutes of a game and we're 3 points down and you're one of my forward players, am I going to keep you on? Are you coachable? A lot of the time when you're looking at drafting any athlete into a sport, if you get down to those final few, from a skill perspective, there may be very little difference between them. So how do you make your difference? You're going to go to a personality profile and have a look at how they interact. You know, you can also see if someone's very, very driven, has no emotional intelligence, and you're going to put them into a team environment. That's a recipe for disaster, because they're not going to be able to interact with their teammates. If people don't do things the same way they do, how much tolerance do they have? How do they cope in a team sport if the team's not doing well and they've done everything right? So it's certainly helpful, you know, when you're looking at those sort of things.
Did I tell you about the thing I was watching on SBS about the SAS?
No.
Did I tell you about that?
I don't think so.
So they did this show. This is the best reality show I've ever seen ever, because it wasn't really like a reality show. It was like a doco. So they got these 30 blokes, regulation blokes, who were anything from plumbers to stand-up comics to martial arts teachers. And these SAS, real deal SAS guys, took them to this place in the middle of nowhere to put them through SAS training, in inverted commas,
wow,
a version of SAS training. And they didn't pull any punches. Like there was,
so they got the real training.
They abused them. They kept them awake for days at a time. They put them in rooms where they had to stand in a certain position and just smash them with loud music. Then they'd come in, pull off, and they're wearing a hood and goggles so they can't see. Then they'd come in and grab them. You know, it was brutal.
Mm.
And two guys made it out of 30.
Yep, and that doesn't surprise me at all.
And their thing was, we don't care how pretty you are, what your IQ is, there was one guy in there built like Superman who thought he was a stud.
Yep.
He was a baby. And all these guys who were super skilled and super fit and super strong and super conditioned, under pressure. And it was like two of the, they call them grey men, which they go unnoticed. They don't stand out. They're not loud. And they go, but at the end of it, these are the guys that if I'm in war, these are the guys I want in the trenches with them. I want this guy. I don't want the guy with a six pack who's done, you know.
I think that what that highlights to us is we do get so carried away. Have a look at the way a lot of leaders are chosen, whether that be a leader as a coach or as a business or whatever. It can often be the loud person or the person who's the most skilled. Yet you could have,
in AFL, the person that they think will add the most value to their brand.
Yep. But if you have a look at some of the most exceptional leaders, you know, they're not necessarily the ones that draw a whole heap of attention, but they can get people to follow them. They have great relationships with everybody. And, you know, I remember when Nick Maxwell was announced at Collingwood, and I remember a lot of the discussion around that appointment, because he wasn't the superstar and whatever it is. And yet everyone you speak to, and I have not met him, but everybody you speak to says what an outstanding leader and probably the best captain they've ever had. And that's, you know, I think that's a perfect example. You know, and I think, you know, when we start to look at how we make our choices, that's again where we come back to some of that personality profiling, because it'll come out in that, some of their qualities, but it may not necessarily come out in their behaviours.
Well, and some of the best footballers make the worst coaches.
Correct.
You know, and some of the guys who were run-of-the-mill footballers, not superstars, make great coaches. Before we go to the break, we'll take one call. Let's go to John in St. Helena. Helena. Yep. G'day, John.
Hi, guys. How are you? Look, I watched that show, SAS, Who Dares Win.
Did you like it?
Oh, man, it was unbelievable.
How
it was actually true induction. Those two actually made it through to then go on to do the SAS training.
Amazing.
It was just phenomenal. So that big guy, the one you were talking about, actually got through to the last three.
Yeah.
And what let him down, when they had to go out on site and do their rough terrain tracking, they gave him a scenario. They had to come up with a scenario, and he accidentally kept burning his mates.
Yeah.
So
therefore, it was all about being, if they get caught in war situation, how they would react. And the grey man was exactly it.
Yeah, it was great.
Answering with opening questions.
John, can you remember the name of the show?
SAS, Who Dares Wins.
SAS, Who Dares. I'm going to look that
so
up.
So if anyone, thanks for your call, John. It was a great show, and thanks for your endorsement. If anyone wants to, if you can get a hold of it, it's only about maybe five episodes. Watch it start to finish, and I've kind of buggered it up a tiny bit for you, but you'll enjoy it. Hey, we've got a good guest. We've got a great guest coming in the studio very soon. His name's Rob Paterson, or as he likes to call himself, Rob Paterson,
right?
With one T. He'll be in on the other side. This very interesting cat. Stick around, the Science of Sport.
On 11.16 SEN, the Science of Sport with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada and Mark Fabreo.
Welcome back. 28 minutes past 10 o'clock. The Science Sport. Jackie Lauder, Craig Harper. Mark Fabreo is away. We're here till 11 o'clock. After that, BP with the first serve and then Sports Central all afternoon. Couple of SMSs.
Yeah, so from South Australian Mark Cosgrove, with weight issues prevented him from playing for Australia. And Mark Taylor, great example of a great player. Not a great player, but a great captain and leader.
Yeah. Yeah, very good SMSs. Yeah. And also the one you didn't read out, we're talking about people who could have done better. Humphrey Bear, Ray from Richmond said he should have spoken more. Ray, not very insightful, but really funny. So if you can send through something else funny, that'd be good. Now, through the week, I'm always meeting interesting people, and this week was no different. This week I met a man who's got a really interesting story. He's an athlete, he's a coach, he's an exercise scientist. He works in the space of high performance. He's worked with lots of elite athletes, which makes him very, very relevant to this show, but also is an elite athlete himself. It has a very interesting story. His name's Rob Patterson, and he joins us now. Hi, mate.
Yeah, g'day, how you going?
Come in a little bit close to that microphone. We're going very good. Now, let's start at the beginning, which is always a good place. Tell us, so you're sitting there in a wheelchair. Tell us about that. Tell us about how that came to be.
Yeah, okay. So I was doing triathlons in 1991, had taken up the sport early on in the late 80s. I was cycling just outside of Albury on a training ride one morning and got hit by a semi-trailer. Ran into the back of me at 110 k's an hour. And sent me into hospital for 6 months, fairly serious injuries. The one that wasn't going to kill me, but the one that was the most lasting, was a spinal injury. So it left me in a wheelchair.
How does someone get hit by a truck at 110 kilometres an hour and not be dead?
I'm not sure about that. Fortunate. I was fit at the time. My body kind of held together well for the early parts, and then I was in an induced coma for 4 months. Four weeks.
Mm.
And basically just a lot of good support and a lot of good nursing and doctors around to pull me back.
So what's your level of function now? Upper body all normal, all good?
Yeah. So basically from the hips down, and paralyzed. Yeah.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 25 at the time.
Wow, 25.
Yeah.
At that age,
physical
where you
peak.
Think
yep.
Everything's ahead of you, and accident is shattering at any age. But at 25, that's just incredibly sad.
So you've come out of a coma a month after the accident, give or take, and you're kind of just getting your bearings. And what do you remember of the first day or so of going, all right, well, how did they tell you? Were you shocked? Were you just, I don't know, indifferent because you couldn't grasp it?
It was an induced coma, so it kind of felt like it was more of a dream.
Right.
And I guess over a period of time, I just felt like I found out. It wasn't like that television moment where, Rob, you're not going to walk again, and the music goes down and you're in shock. It was...
That's disappointing.
It sounds disappointing that you didn't get the...
Yeah. Yeah. Were you hoping for a bit of that?
Well, I also didn't get like that part where I'm lying in bed and I'm floating above myself looking down either.
Right.
Get any
you
of
got
that.
Ripped off.
I know.
Totally.
Was it, but the experience.
Who was it who died and said there's nothing there? Was it Kerry Packer? He said, I've died, come back, there's nothing there.
Yeah, well, I actually did a couple of times and didn't see much, so I'm not sure. But it was kind of, it happened over a period, so it wasn't like a moment that I found out. And I guess it took a while to sink in, but I'm pragmatic by nature. So my first reaction was, okay, I've got to get on with this. I've got to make the most of what I have.
Mm.
For that period of time, I certainly realised that the people around me suffered through a lot while I was having a snooze.
Mm.
And it was important for me that, to hold myself together for them as well, and that I needed to return that. And I guess it's one of those things people always say to me, when did you get over it? Well, you never get over it.
Right.
Every day you wake up, it's the same thing. And you've always got challenges. Mine's more overt than others.
Yep.
And you're always dealing with it.
It's a big point though, isn't it? Like I, as most of the listeners know, I work on the motorbike circuit. And so I do spend a lot of time, unfortunately, when we have spinal injuries. And that's such a big point, is what the families go through. Like in those initial stages, the patient themselves doesn't know what's going on. There's often a series of operations and things like that to stabilize someone's spine and body, and whatever. But it, that's a big journey for the family. So it's interesting to hear you recognise that.
How did your family cope?
Oh, they were fantastic. They were absolutely amazing. My family and friends really held together well, and just made it so much easier for me. Because, you know, it is a shock, and it's something that it takes a while to adapt to, but they were amazing. They're an amazing group of people.
How do you go now when you're working with athletes, because you're a conditioning coach, among other things? Are there any either practical or perhaps, what's the word, sociological issues? Like, do people going, I'm not sure, really? Do they respect you as much or more or less? Or
obviously
they should respect you as much or more, but I'm just wondering, there's some people going, I don't know.
Look, I'm sure that there are people who do. I don't get it very often.
Good.
My comeback will sometimes be mildly amusing with people. I coach football, and I've been involved in Australian rules football for a long time from a coaching perspective. And when people, you know, say, oh, how can you teach someone to kick? Well, when I was at uni, I wrote a 14,000-word paper on the biomechanics of kicking. So I understand the mechanics. I understand how to kick. And I think it comes down to your ability to communicate
Sure.
So if you can communicate, I don't think I necessarily, well, obviously I can't demonstrate that skill, but I can teach someone how to do it by communicating well to them and using others when needed.
But I think, isn't that a common thing in sport? I've been asked before, well, how do you work in footy if you've never played?
Well, you don't race motorbikes.
No,
but don't. Yeah,
that's
train the Melbourne Vixens, but I can't play netball.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you were saying kind of ties in with what we were saying before in terms of leadership and that communication side of it. If you know your stuff, you don't have to be able to demonstrate. That's their job. They're the athletes.
Yeah, and I guess initially probably you do have to prove yourself sometimes, and I guess that with me, people hear my story, and that's kind of that first hook to go, okay, you've been through something, you're reasonably resilient. And then I talk about the fact that I've coached athletes, and the further that goes on, the more experience I get, the more credibility I get, I guess, with that as a starting point. So it puts you in a reasonable place to start with.
What did you learn about yourself in that whole process? Because you can't plan for that.
No.
So in that whole journey, I guess, until where you are now, what's the most important thing you've learned about yourself?
I think that I'm empathetic by nature.
Yep.
And you were talking about leadership earlier on, and about emotional intelligence. And it's something that I've read Goldman's book, and I find it amazing. I think it's really interesting. I think it's an area that any coach should look into and understand well. I realized that, upon reflection, that the coaches that I had as a junior athlete had an enormous impact on my life.
Yeah.
And that's why I went into coaching. And I didn't realise at the time, because I didn't kind of find out probably till I was in my mid-20s after the accident. And the sorts of people they were helped me to become the sort of person I was.
Yeah. And coaches, I think that, and teachers have a huge influence, don't they? Oh,
enormous. Absolutely enormous. And my coaching now, I know that the things I say have impacts on the athletes I work with. I absolutely know it, and I use that. And I'm involved in a junior football coaching program at the moment, where I'm going to be coaching coaches, because I see the critical phase that they work, especially with young men between sort of 12 and 18, the impact you can have on people at that age. And I think that it's really important that they go about it the right way.
We're chatting with Rob Patterson, who took on a truck in 1991. I just thought he'd give that a crack. What month in 1991 was that?
I was in October.
October 1991. When was your first? Well, I'm sure you did I was going to say a truckload. That's a terrible. I'm sure you did a truckload of rehab.
I actually don't know if Rob's going to come back after having you speak to him this morning. What did you ask him out in the green room?
What?
You asked him.
Why he's not a Paralympian? He's got the skill.
Are you a Paralympian? He says no. And you say, why not?
I'm trying to encourage him.
And I say, lack of talent.
Well, that's a lie. That's a lie. You've clearly got the talent. When did you do your first, in inverted commas, training session?
Afterwards.
After the accident.
Yeah. So I was living in Albury at the time, and it would have been after I got out of hospital, but within a couple of weeks, I was out at Latchford Barracks in Albury, swimming in the pool there.
Wow.
Because we had a good a triathlon group I was involved with, had a relationship with the army group out there, and they let us use their pool.
Wow.
Yeah,
and so it started from there.
Yeah, started swimming again.
And just fast forwarding a long way, and we'll fill in the gaps, but this year you did the Hawaii Ironman.
I did. I did Kona in October, and I didn't finish because we were talking about the heat earlier on. I actually got 130Ks into the bike ride, and the heat got the better of me, and I crashed my bike and rolled it a couple of times.
Ooh. Wowza.
That's a big event though, isn't it? Like, that's a big event for anybody. But, you know, when you've got some other challenges, and I think this is one of the things that a lot of people don't understand, for anyone who's in a wheelchair or with spinal injuries, the body management required is quite significant.
Yeah, the physiology is a little bit different,
yeah,
isn't it?
So yeah,
in terms of managing core body temperature and blood pressure and all of those things.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about with the swim, excuse my ignorance, just don't know the answer, with the swim, it's 3.8, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
And do you have any aids or any, or is it just harder for you?
No, yeah, just harder. We're allowed to wear a wetsuit. So in right. Kona is always a non, or the Ironman's in Hawaii is the non-wetsuit swim because of the water temperature.
Right.
The what they call the PT1, so the athletes with the paralysis are allowed to wear a wetsuit to help leg buoyancy.
It's not a big help, really.
It's well, I guess
3.8 swim with no kicking. That's like 20Ks.
Yeah. Yeah, but I guess you know that when you're doing all the training.
Yeah, and the main challenge on the bike is, if you imagine it's a recumbent bike with your legs out in front, beside yep. of the front wheels, so it's like lying on a banana lounge.
Yeah.
So I was sunbaking in 40-plus degree heat yeah. on a banana lounge for yeah. 8 hours.
How many athletes did they have in your category?
This year there were four
okay.
athletes in the, yeah.
Which shows you what an amazing effort that is when worldwide you got four people that are prepared to enter that. Like, that's quite significant as well.
We're chatting with Rob Patterson. If you've got a question or a comment, if you want to have a chat with him, if you want to ask him something, if you want a little bit of insight, not only is he a great athlete, he's also a coach. If you want to chat with him, 9429 1116, or if you want to send a message, 0433 98 1116. Listening to The Science Sport. We'll be back in a min.
On 1116 SEN, The Science of Sport with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada and Mark Fabreo.
Welcome back to Melbourne's Home of Sport, The Science of Sport, 16 minutes to 11 o'clock. We were talking about, among other things, a show on the SBS called SAS Who Dares Wins, and people performing under pressure. A couple of SMSs for you, Jacqueline, to read out.
Yes. Aiden in Bayswater, Bob Murphy and Lenny Hayes, got to be some of the best grey men. I'd probably agree with that.
And we're talking about grey men being yeah. the guys that fly a bit below the radar, that
yep.
just super resilient, super tough, get the job done, not extroverts, low-key, high performers.
Yep. Andrew from Bundura, Michael Voss, ex-Brisbane player and captain, absolute champion of the game, but couldn't cut it as a coach.
Yeah.
We're also talking
about people who are not necessarily great footballers but made great coaches or vice versa.
Well, he went from being captain one year to coach the next. And I remember reading an article on him, and he said, "I am arrogant, but I can back it up." And I remember sitting there going, this is going to end in disaster, because he has no understanding of what coaching is. And I bet you if you asked him now that he has gone through that experience, did you have any idea what coaching was about? He would have gone, no.
Would he though?
Well,
would he say that though?
He'd have to.
You would
hope he's had some sort of learning. Anyway, Ray's off the mark because you told him to start sending funny things in. So he said, "Have you heard a conversation between Humphrey and Fat Cat?" Nope, neither have I.
Tish.
So now I mentioned to you earlier, and I.
By the way, Rob Patterson is Mark Fabreo for the next 20 for the next 15 minutes.
Good morning.
Rob Patterson is just co-hosting.
So I mentioned to you in the outside before, I get a lot of people that will come in to my office and say, "I heard this from somewhere, I read this," and they've followed some article that might have been in a magazine and followed the advice and then come in and say, "Oh, it didn't work." And one of the things I think a lot of people do struggle with is knowing how to find a credible source for information. There is a lot of information out there, and you and I both know the internet is not monitored. So anybody...
What?
I know we all think that if it's on the internet, it must be true.
You mean Dr. Google is not a real doctor?
Yeah. So I think, you know, from our end, there's probably a couple little tips we could give people when you're trying to find a credible source. Number one is, if you do find whoever's written that article, have a look at what their qualifications are. And look up what those, because a lot of the time they're going to be letters after somebody's name and you're not going to know what they mean. But have a look at what those letters are. Because I saw a psychologist on a media outlet.
Wow, someone's being evasive, yes.
Well, I don't want to name anybody because that's not my job to do that.
Right.
But anyway, this person had in their bio on this particular show said that, you know, they were an expert in this and an expert in that. And I feel like I'm pretty good with certain areas. And I looked up this person, and this person has only been registered as a psychologist for 12 months. But because they were a lot older, I think they use their age to say, oh, I'm an expert in this. Well, 1 year doesn't make you an expert if you've only been registered for a year. You haven't got enough experience in that role.
And can I give tip two?
Yep.
If the advice or the information comes from a magazine with Kim Kardashian on the front,
yes,
it's probably not, you know,
the most credible.
Rob, have you got a suggestion for if people are looking for info on nutrition or training or performance, where they might go?
Yeah, I guess. Looking at people's background, what they've done before, if they've written any research articles or they've been involved in research in some ways. Often a really good source if they've, you know, been involved in writing a credible book. But yeah, I don't think maybe the Kardashians are not
unlike me, who's written lots of incredible.
Well, I think what it depends too on what somebody's claiming. Like there was there's an ad on TV on the radio at the moment, and I can't even remember the name of the company that's doing this, but I nearly drove my car off the road when I heard it the other day, because they basically said it was some fat blasting thing that in one session you would lose 24% of your body fat.
No.
That's what they were actually claiming.
See, I wish I was a billionaire, because I'd just take all these people to court, because that is
yeah.
That is ridiculous.
And I felt like saying, yeah, so you're only going to pay this one off about 25 times.
unless that procedure involves a chainsaw and a lot of blood, that is not happening. And also, I guess, obviously, the last one for the moment anyway, is from the horse's mouth. So people who are success, like somebody like you, who's got years and years of experience working at the forefront, working at the coalface of psychology and dealing with real people with real problems, or from an exercise point of view, somebody like me who started in the fitness industry 33 years ago, don't know everything, but got a bit of a clue, worked with thousands of people. So I think with respect, you know, if you're talking to a trainer who qualified on Tuesday, maybe seek out somebody and you know, all due respect, I think that trainer would say the same thing. There's probably someone who knows a bit more than me at this point in time.
But I think that's your key, is if you get a source that says you need to go here for more information, here's a little bit, but they're prepared to refer
say, absolutely,
look, this is where you've got to go, that means that probably what they've told you is accurate, because they're not claiming the world. They're not claiming something that's going to fix everything.
Yeah.
And the other thing I think in line with this topic, and you guys would have found it both in your job, is I had a discussion with somebody the other day, and their family was getting very frustrated that I wasn't making them do certain things. And I said to them, well, my job isn't to make you do certain things. That's your choices are your choices. My job is to highlight and help you with the things that you need assistance with, and then provide you some sort of guidance as to where you might be able to try that out, or how you might have coped better with a situation. But it's not my job to make you, if you're not confident, all of a sudden be confident and go and do things you would never do anyway.
A couple of minutes ago, Jackie Lauder said Michael Voss was no good. Suresh wants to... She kind of said it, but not really. Let's go to Suresh, who wants to talk about Michael Voss. He is from Caulfield. Morning, mate.
Hey, peeps. Love your show.
Thank you.
I listen to you guys on my way to the gym every Sunday morning.
Go and get big, brother.
Yeah, well, that's a plan. Grow some legs. I just wanted to pick up on Michael Voss. Michael Voss actually coached the side to within one game of the finals that year, where he got the sack. And they only sacked him because they wanted to get Paul Roos. He actually was also in the media for a couple of years before he went to coach Brisbane. I don't know if you guys watched that show on Foxtel with The Recruit.
The Recruit.
he was phenomenal coaching these guys who, some of them had never even played AFL before, and just watching him motivate them and just tap into their psyche was quite interesting.
Yeah, now I think he's, because he had all of those years coaching, the recruits well after he's had years of coaching behind him. So he's not, how he's coaching there is definitely not how he would have been coaching. And while some of those facts that I said, I might have been off with some of that, that you're never going to get rid of a coach just to get another coach. Like, not but if they're doing a good job.
I do remember that. You're right, Suresh, in that it was, he wasn't having a bad year that year considering what he had to work with. Am I right?
Yeah, exactly. I didn't even go for Brisbane, but I was shattered that they got rid of him.
Hey, mate, thanks for your call. Go and get on the leg press, do some squats and grow some quads. Hey, Rob, working with, we're talking about high performers and people who haven't maybe fulfilled their talent. Is that for you one of the challenges being a coach, working with people who maybe you think their potential is not as great as their confidence, or they don't necessarily know how could they or good they could be, or two, maybe they just self-sabotage with crappy thinking?
Yeah, I think there's both. I guess potential is an interesting thing because until you reach it, that's all it is. And I've probably seen similar things with some athletes that you think the sky's the limit and they just never get there. And I kind of like to then dissect and understand what are the factors that contribute to that. The Vossi one's an interesting one because situational coaching to some degree, like he might be really good with young boys who are trying and haven't reached that level, but is he the same with a bunch of guys who think that they're, you know, they're at that level and they're already there? There's
you were going to say something factors. Inappropriate for radio,
it's,
weren't
no,
you?
No, I wasn't.
It's hard to be a coach when you've played with some of the players. So you were a teammate and now you're coaching them. That's a very hard dynamic. And whilst you as the coach might make that shift, that doesn't mean that the players are going to find that really easy. And I think if you've been equals with someone and a peer and now all of a sudden they've got that level of authority and they are choosing your selection, that there's a lot of boundaries that can get crossed there and a lot of confusion in relationships. And I think that does often contribute to why a coach may not be so successful.
Yeah. Can I change directions? Just, we've got about 1 minute before an ad. Just quickly, how much, give or take, does a bike, the kind of bike you need for competition, if you've just joined us, Rob is a paraplegic athlete and he's a coach and he's really smart and he's joining us. How much does the bike that you use cost, give or take? And I know it's probably a broad range, but...
The ones for decent competition are around $20,000.
And what about your chair, like competition?
Race chair is around about $8,000.
Wow. That's a lot of money, isn't it?
It's, I mean, that's high entry point. Yeah.
Listening to the Science Sport, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wind it up.
On 11.16 SEN, the Science of Sport with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada and Mark Fabreo.
Ray.
You gave him license and geez, he's taken it.
Welcome back to the Science of Sport. just quickly, Rob Patterson's joined us in the studio. We're going to have to get him in again because we didn't give him enough time. Just quickly, mate, so we know you crashed and burned. You crashed in Hawaii this year after 130 Ks and lying at supine on your bike. What's next on the competitive horizon?
So I'm going to Cairns again to try and qualify for Hawaii in October again in 2016. So that's my main aim for next year.
Do you have to re-qualify each year?
Yes, yeah, you have to qualify.
Really?
Yep.
So when you go to Cairns, are you doing a half or a full?
Yeah, this time it's the half. So the last 2 years or the last 3 years, the qualifying race has been the full Ironman at Cairns. But this year they've changed it to the half is the qualifying race for Kona. So that's nicer.
Is there a possibility that we could have an Ironman in a place that's actually cool?
I don't know.
What
there's
is
one in
it
Canada, that, I think, that's really chilly. Yeah,
I think we
yeah.
just need something in Melbourne in winter where it's like 10 degrees. You're not going to overheat. You're possibly going to get frostbite, but at least you're not going to, your core body temperature is not going to go through the roof.
True.
Yeah. Now, if people want to contact you, we know that you do some coaching, you do some one-on-one stuff, you do stuff with teams, you also do corporate speaking and the like. How can people contact you?
The best way is coretrainers.com.au.
Say that slower.
Coretrainers.com.au.
C-O-R-E trainers, all one word.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and same on Facebook.
Core Trainers, C-O-R-E Trainers, all one word, .com.au. Rob Patterson is his name. He's a good man. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Yeah, thank you. It was great.
Jackie Louder, what's on for you this week?
I've got a couple of Christmas gatherings.
Of course you have. Ho, ho, ho.
Yep, and then just working flat out this week leading into Christmas. So, yeah. Should be good.
Will you enjoy that? Thanks to our producer, Jackie, and our button pusher, whose name I've forgotten. Tell me. Tim, the button pusher. Sorry, Tim. Coming up after 11 o'clock, first serve with Brett Phillips and Paul Aitken, 11 to 12, and then all afternoon, BP will be here sharing love with Sports Central, as he does. And then he's on nights this week sharing the love. I think Finey's doing KB shift or
it's all over the place, isn't it? Silly season.
I'm very confused. Enjoy your week, folks. See you next time.